Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Have you watched any of Next Generation?
No.
It's all on Netflix. I keep downloading it to my phone. It's really good. Picard is totally horny for everyone.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And the second episode of the whole series is that the whole ship accidentally gets a virus that literally makes them all drunk and horny. Would recommend.
Okay, yeah.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, we're talking about the Aretha Franklin live film Amazing Grace and Claire Denis' lo-fi sci-fi high life. Plus, we'll be talking to Claire herself, so be it notes or life, get ready for some stratospheric highs. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining my ramshackle prison of podcasting is the Warden of Wit, Ella Kemp.
Hello.
The Guard of Grace, Steph Watts.
Hi there.
And somehow out of solitary confinement, Sam Howlett is here as well.
Hello.
Steph, it's lovely to have you back. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we're going to be delving into two lovely films this week. Before we talk to Claire Denis about High Life, let's start with Amazing Grace, which is a new but also old at the same time film about Franklin's recording of her seminal album of the same name. It's a live music film that's been a long time coming, but was it worth getting Aretha the action?
Oh, wow.
Ella, tell us a bit more about this one.
Well, thank you, Jake. So, as you say, Amazing Grace recaptures Aretha Franklin's amazingly high-selling, best-selling ever gospel album, Amazing Grace. So the film follows the 2 days of gospel performance. It was at the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in Watts, Los Angeles. So at first, Sidney Pollack and his crew captured all of this really incredible footage, but the project was never released because the footage was mishandled. But here we are 47 years later. The recordings have been brought out, brought to life. The film is completed and it's finally here.
Yeah. So Sidney Pollack, who is down as the director of the film, people may know as the director of massive films like Out of Africa and Tootsie and They Shoot Horses, Don't They? As well as being Will's dad in Will and Grace.
Iconic.
Yeah. And so he's hired to make this documentary about her recording. And then it's initially meant to go out in a publicity manner alongside the release of Superfly. And whilst they're recording it, like, there are some really stupid mistakes. Like, they don't use clapperboards. so they cannot synchronize the footage to the sound. And it's just this enormous nightmare. And as you say, all the footage is locked away. And then all of this celluloid that's just been gathering dust is bought by a guy called Alan Elliott, who's a producer in 2007. He cuts them together into this 90-minute film using sync robot technology that can recognize the sound and the picture a lot better than they could 40 years ago. It plays at festivals, but then he gets sued multiple times by the Aretha Franklin estate. And then since her death, they've managed to settle on that. And eventually, in 2019, we have the film. So after all of that, was this worth the wait?
I mean, it's an astonishing story. And I think just knowing all of that and obviously still listening to Aretha Franklin all the time is obviously such a treat to have all of this footage. And like, it is, it's saved, it's salvaged, this footage. It's not recreated, it's not rehashed, you know, it's not a biopic. She's here and she's back to life again. So that's kind of magic to you know, to be able to see that finally.
Yeah. Steph, you've been lucky enough to watch this a few months ago now, and you've had time to ruminate on it. And I know it's been one of your favourites of the year.
Yeah, I saw it in Berlin. Yeah, I didn't really know what to expect because I knew it was a documentary, but didn't kind of fully realise how much of a kind of concert film live recording it was. And yeah, just kind of, you have all these kind of bitty kind of shots where they've pieced together bits where the sound hasn't matched up and they've had to kind of take it from kind of other parts of the recording. But yeah, you kind of, she like opens her mouth to sing and like I kind of turned to my left and right and there wasn't a dry eye like in the row kind of that I was sitting on. It's just like absolutely astonishing like that you have that, yeah, that footage, and it's kind of so intimate. And it really feels like you're kind of in the room with her.
And it's not really a director's film. This is completely led by performance. It's not like we've got Sidney Pollack wanting to put his stamp on it at any time. And it's got flaws, technical flaws, as you already mentioned, Steph. There are still those moments where they can't piece it together as perfectly, and it has this scrapbook flavour to it. But in a way that kind of might aid the film as well, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's shots where you kind of, there'll be like somebody with their finger over the lens, or like they'll swing round and you'll see the director in the corner being like, get that shot over there, like waving his arms and stuff. So it's definitely kind of, yeah, definitely not kind of a totally polished kind of finished result. But then you get these like really lovely moments, I think, where like Aretha Franklin's father is like in the audience and he kind of gets up to like mop a bit of sweat off her brow when she's like at the piano. Just like really kind of good moments like that that you might not get if it was kind of a fully realised like big stage concert film in that way.
And you do get the sense that this concert, it was a once in a lifetime thing. It's a one of a kind event. And the fact that they can't go back and reshoot it, that those shots with the finger over the lens, if that's the shot they've got and that's the one they've got to use, because it's not going to happen again. And it makes you appreciate just how special it must have been. And how do you think this really kind of objective, scrappy style compares to the more stylized music docs that maybe we're more familiar with getting now, the more narrative based stuff? I'm thinking like 20,000 Days on Earth, the Nick Cave film, like that is all there to, as much as there is a performance that's central to it, it's about heightening the mythos of the character of Nick Cave, as well as the performance.
Well, there's the National film as well, that's kind of
Mistaken for Strangers.
Yeah, that kind of blurs the line between what a concert film can and can't be, and like music doc.
Yeah, it's like the lead singer from the National. I don't really know the National very well.
Right.
Apologies. But yeah, he hires his brother, who's like out of work at the time, to like come along with him and film this documentary. And that's very kind of, yeah, you get shots of him just kind of messing around with the camcorder. Yeah. And it's just like, oh, I can see myself in the mirror and stuff like that. But yeah, and that's definitely like a using like the National's music and like concert doc to form a different narrative and personal narrative for that filmmaker. So that's definitely one where you can see kind of different stories coming into
play. Then there's Gimme Shelter as well, which is originally was supposed to just be a doc about this free festival, but it actually ends up capturing how this day just went from bad to worse, where like the crowd got so big, there were people, there's like a footage of someone getting murdered, and you see the Rolling Stones watching the footage afterwards about how this concert went so wrong. So it's kind of, it's a different one where it's like they just wanted to film a normal music doc, but ended up being so much more and so much weirder.
Yeah.
And then the other end of that is Stop Making Sense, the film about the Talking Heads.
This is like an all-timer for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. I love it. And it's, yeah, we were talking about this earlier about how stylized Stop Making Sense is. Like, because, you know, Amazing Grace is very much let Aretha Franklin work her magic, whereas it's hard to tell with Stop Making Sense if Jonathan Demme's like, let's just look at the Talking Heads for a while, or whether there's a bit more of his kind of stamp on the film.
But then the Talking Heads are doing so much within their show from the very, you know, from the second it starts. When the concert and the film then ends, you think, how in the world did I get here? And it's just David Byrne, you know, leading this stage, this performance, and directing it so much that I wonder, as a filmmaker, what do you do with that? Do you collaborate on that process, or are you just kind of you know, blessed to have a camera that's recording to just give this to a wider audience. And that's another thing that's, I think, that's amazing about Amazing Grace, is for all of us to have the opportunity to see it on a very, very, very big screen.
And loud.
And very loud, yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, the Prince Charles Cinema in London did a screening of Stop Making Sense a few months ago, which I'm annoyed I didn't go to, but it must have been magic to see that so big. So, yeah, I think it's an exciting time to, you know, we found this lost footage of Aretha Franklin and see it as big as and as loud as we can.
Yeah. All right. So that was Amazing Grace. It's now time to move on to a sci-fi film that operates in a different realm of performance, the sexual, mysterious and unique pleasures of high life. So this film follows a crew of prisoners. They're adrift in deep space on a mission headed towards oblivion or salvation in the heart of a black hole. Now, they're made up of death row inmates. That's the twist. They've been repurposed for interstellar travel. And our lead is Monty, played by Robert Pattinson, who finds himself caught in a web of sexual and existential frustration with Juliette Binoche's scientist Dibs at the event horizon of the whole thing. And we were actually lucky enough to talk to Claire Denis about the film. So we'll go to that and then we'll come back to our review.
Good morning, Claire Denis. Thank you so much for speaking to me on the Curzon podcast. We're here to talk about High Life.
Yes.
The film. Congratulations on the film. We've all, at Curzon, we've all loved it. First of all, I want to ask you a question about the setting of the film. I've read that you have described the film as wanting to look like a prison, and yet it's set in space. So I wonder how you reconcile
those two ideas. The question, you shouldn't ask it like that. The thing is, those people are convicted, condemned to death, and they are slowly dying in the death corridor somewhere in America, and they are used as lab rats to experiencing in space, you know, mm-hmm. like surviving after you leave the solar system for years, you know. So they choose that kind of slow death, that desperate death they are proposed in a jail. In a death corridor, and then with a little injection. That's all for me.
Mm-hmm. And because it's set in space and everyone speaks English, I was wondering why you think that is, that it had to be set in English.
Have you ever heard about a cosmonaut speaking Greek or Spanish?
I haven't.
Do you know which language are spoken in space for cosmonaut? Do you know?
I'd guess English.
American, not English, American and Russian. And I guess soon Chinese.
And so it was never an option to, I guess, to transpose that world with French.
Even the French people who travel in space today, there are few, I mean, travel in the space station, which is not far from Earth. They do speak Russian and English. Mm-hmm. There is no other language.
So finding your crew then who speaks English, how was that?
And I also, there was a thing, I know a little bit less about death penalty in Russia. Mm-hmm. There is more knowledge about it in America, because in the US, people are fighting against it.
And so working with that crew in space and casting the team that you have, I wonder how you went about creating these characters. I'm thinking with Robert Pattinson as well. I heard that a casting director suggested him to you, but that he'd also approached you to work on a project before. So did you have more of the character in mind, or was that created?
No, when we wrote the script, we described the character without knowing who was going to be in it, actually. No. Maybe the character of Monty, I thought, could be a little bit older than Robert. But that's all.
Mm. So what do you think that he brought to the role?
It's impossible to describe how much he brought, because when you're writing a script, it also a very high level of expectation, you know. So it reached my expectation, like André Benjamin, mm-hmm. also like Juliette Binoche, of course, like Mia Gott, like our little baby, like Jessie.
She was sensational. How was it working with such a young actor? With a young baby?
You mean Jessie?
Scarlett, yes.
Scarlett, the baby?
Sorry, yes, the baby.
Oh, Scarlett was not acting. She's a baby, sure. You know. I mean, Jessie is fantastic, yes. Mm-hmm. It's true, yeah. The baby is great, but it's not acting. It's...
Yeah.
She was directed by Robert, and we were around, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did they spend a lot of time together before the shoot?
No. She arrived the day we start shooting.
Oh, wow. Mm. So they had to bond instantly.
No, Robert knew her parents.
Okay.
He had seen her when she was a baby. But he had to do a great, great... He was 100% concentrated on a relation with Scarlett, and I think that's why we start shooting 9 days only with both of them. That's the beginning of shoot, you know, so that we keep that.
And so those space costumes, how did you come to design that kind of style?
We make a mixture of more or less they look like the Russian costume mm-hmm. of today.
Mm. Okay.
I like their style very much. They're simple and they are beige and blue. I thought they were great for the prison look. Mm.
I wanted to ask about, very briefly, about the fuck box. Because
yes.
I read that at first you had called it the love machine.
Oh, the script was written in French. Uh-huh. And in the French version, Jean-Paul and I, we call it the love machine.
What did you call it in French?
Love machine.
Just the English words in the French script.
Yeah, because the love machine had this ridiculous taste, you know?
Right.
You know? Love machine. You know, it's a song, a famous song.
Yeah.
You know? So we are French, but we are not completely... we have some culture too, you know?
Of course.
So, Love Machine was a funny nickname. And then Stuart Staple, the musician, one day said, oh, let's call it a fuck box. That's better. And that's the way we call it.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much.
Is it brilliant?
The film is brilliant, in my opinion. Okay. So,
thank you. I'm not brilliant. Not at all.
To lots of us. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, thank you, Claire. High Life. Not quite as much a long wait as Amazing Grace had, but it also took its time getting here. I think the first draft of this script was out in 2011. There was various different people brought on to take a look at the project. At one point, even Zadie Smith was brought on to take a look at the script, but her and Claire Denis didn't get along. And I think the first time Robert Pattinson saw it was in 2013. In the time that they were getting this going, she went off and made a whole other film that was Let the Sunshine In. And then eventually we get this one. So for the second time today, was this one worth the wait?
Well, I'm still kind of catching up with Claire Denis' work. It's only been in the past kind of couple of years that I've started getting to grips with her films. But was definitely like really, really interested to see this. Like, I love space movies. I love Robert Pattinson. So like, it was a really kind of interesting thing to come into. Like, how is this all going to work together?
Yeah, I think there was a general hype machine rolling for this for quite a few years. Just that those few words of Claire Denis science fiction, and that's what people were latching onto and were very excited about. And let's look at the sci-fi angle then. How does this film operate as a science fiction film? How does it work within that genre? How does it break from it?
Well, I think if you know the sort of logline of this film, death row mates are sent into space to harness the power of the energy from a black hole. That's very much like a sort of mid to late 90s Jerry Bruckheimer movie. You know, you can see this being like a sort of Con Air in space kind of thing.
Yep.
Or a sort of Roland Emmerich film. And Roland Emmerich has, as of today recordings, officially signed on to make Moonfall. Moonfall, by the way, is a mega budget sci-fi blockbuster that he's been trying to make for years about the moon falling
out. Guess what it's about, yeah.
The moon's falling out of orbit and is heading towards Earth.
Oh my God.
So a team of astronauts are sent up to put it back in its place.
Had he talked to Claire Denis about this?
She could have really nailed.
She could have nailed this in Moonfall.
Yeah, Moonfall's going to severely lack in having a fuckbox.
Well, that's the thing, is that this plot could be this sort of pulpy action blockbuster. But Claire Denis makes it so much weirder, so much more nightmarish by adding in this really weird sort of sexual angle to the film. And the Juliette Binoche character, Dibs, is so sort of feels like from another film, but then makes everyone else in the film part of that film that she's from.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, she's almost like a Wicked Witch of the West.
She absolutely is, yeah.
Ella, how did you grapple with this film? Because there's a lot to get into here. But once we've got beyond the sci-fi element of it, this is a film about people having to figure out how to live together.
Yeah, absolutely. It was also one of the earlier films of Claire Denis that I came to. And I like my space movies, but I think a lot of the time they do just kind of wash over me. And, you know, while they're dealing with all the various things to do with science and rockets and all of that, I think, yeah, fine, you know, but are the people so interesting? Sorry.
Breaking my heart here.
But no, but
science,
you know,
rockets. But
that's exactly what I sound like.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I appreciate them, but I don't always feel completely immersed by them. And that's kind of what I thought it would be going into High Life. But then, as you say, Sam, it's got all of these different angles that I just found it so gripping and just completely hypnotising in a way that I'm still not completely sure why, but I really, really appreciate there's... I think it's all down to the humans, and in the sense that, yes, this... I think everything in this very strange, mysterious, dark film has to exist in the orbit and universe that it is. But essentially, I wonder whether it could have been made out of space. Like, so much of it relies on their very strange politics with each other and their bodies and their biological and sexual and psychological needs and all of that. And I just find that realm really fascinating in a way that, with other space movies, when I leave the film, I think that was a space movie. They were in a rocket and, you know, there were stars and planets and that was the mission. Whereas this is a very carnal mission. I think that's really exciting.
Yeah. So because the film kind of plays its hand right at the start, we see Robert Pattinson with a newborn baby that he's trying to raise. We see that at the very beginning of the film, all the other members of the crew have died. And we have about 20 minutes of him having to deal with the fallout of that whilst having to care for a child. I'm sure any new parents who are listening will understand the terror that he's going through there. Like, we've all been having to tighten a screw on the outside of our spaceship whilst our baby cries on the inside and we can't do anything about it. But because we're given the fact, given the baby, we're given the dead crew right at the beginning.
Stunning title sequence, by the way. Mm. Goodness me.
Yeah. Once we actually delve into how that all happened, because we know how it's going to play out already, we can almost spend more time figuring out just who these people are and delve into just the complete nightmare that is Dibs and her fantastical constructions, including a box that creates a sequence that no one will be forgetting anytime soon. And along the way, we've got Andre 3000, who is just like pals with Denis now. And apparently they text every week to check in with each other. Mia Goth, who is just checking off European auteur one after the other after great work in Suspiria. And there's a lot going on because they are there as death row prisoners. We've got to figure out why they're there. What did they do? Does it really matter? But also there's this experiment. Can they get pregnant? And they've got to go into a black hole to figure out whether they can harness the energy of it. It's busy whilst also being really desolate at the same time.
There's a lot of business in this film.
Yeah.
Too much business for my liking. There's this kind of, as I said earlier, this kind of pulpy concept of death row inmates in space. And on top of that, you have the sex stuff. And the sex stuff probably takes up about 3 hours of the film.
for a two-hour film.
I know, yeah, somehow. But there's this ideas of sexuality and desire, and then also the fears of fatherhood, and also I think there's something in here about how we treat prisoners and the idea of this kind of weird community. There's just so much thrown in together. On top of that, there's also a black hole and a spaceship. And I think there's one scene that is set on Earth where this guy, two non-characters are talking about the concept of the film.
Yeah, that's rough.
Which is a sort of exposition.
It's got no place being.
Yeah. But I think when you have this much going on, you feel like you need this one scene just like, okay, here's what's happening, and now you can go back to
something that's tethering you to like, this is the story. But I don't think
that was like the big misstep for me.
Yeah.
I feel like that totally broke the mood of the film, and you could trim that out, and I think you kind of get it. You can piece it all together. She's not over-explaining other stuff. Why do we need to over-explain that?
Yeah. But having said that I think there's too much going on, I think that Ella's right that this isn't just people on a mission heading towards a black hole, because we've seen that film, we've seen it in Interstellar and Event Horizon and so many other countless sci-fi films. And Claire Denis has very much made a Claire Denis film in space. You know, it's got that elliptical narrative. It's got those sort of eerily beautiful shots. It's got graphic sex followed by graphic violence. This is very much sort of trouble every day Claire Denis rather than that Le Sun Shining Claire Denis.
And so we've got this kind of life-giving rocket plummeting with full momentum into this hole.
What is she saying?
Yes. but it's severely lacking desire. That's the interesting thing. It's not a very sexy film for the amount of sex that's in it. And it's really cold for...
Sex does not come off very well in this film.
No.
I think as well, because it's so kind of... out of a lot of kind of space films, it really deals with like kind of oblivion and the void and like what's out there. Like, yeah, is it really worth it type thing? I think maybe that's why it kind of leaves it a bit cold. Like, yeah, a lot of kind of...
From the very start.
Yeah. And a lot of big space films, I think, like, cling to life and cling to, like, Earth and that kind of thing. But then this just, like, completely lets go of it. And, like, even sex is, like, not something that you can kind of make contact through.
Well, like, I think a lot of sci-fi films can be quite romantic in the sense of dreaming of what lies beyond and you know, the worlds we haven't explored and the things we can do. Whereas, as you say, Steph, like, this is oblivion. Like, this is the end. This is death. This is people who have wronged. And this is people who now have to pay for that. And
I'm clearly getting a really different read, because I think, like, by the end of the film, it totally is that. And it is like...
Do you think it's hopeful?
Yeah. To me, the last 20 minutes of this is essential for the rest of the film to work. I won't say what that is, but it's like the closest that Claire Denis is going to get to making a Spielberg film is the like particularly the final moments, I think, are totally key to all of it and give it this warmth and hope that just isn't there and is your reward for getting through oblivion.
I think it's really rewarding. And I, having said everything about death and oblivion, I don't think it's grim in the sense that she's such an exciting and sensitive filmmaker that everything she touches just kind of comes to life with this humanity that can either become grim and bland and dead or can be overly sugary and optimistic and everything. But yeah, I think it's just so mysterious. I don't know where that middle ground quite is yet.
Yeah, maybe it's one for people to make their minds up over. It's not necessarily Interstellar, though, is it, Sam?
It's more like Intercourse Stellar.
Yeah.
Or Deeper Impact.
Good, really good. We've mentioned quite a few films there, but tonally maybe one for people looking for a middle ground between Sunshine and Under the Skin, maybe.
I think so, yeah. I think sci-fi is often, for me anyway, feels like the least sort of sexy genre. But when it does sex, it Under the Skin is the one you think of, I guess. And this can be another one for that.
Yep. We put a call out on Twitter asking if you had to join a crew of space adventurers from a sci-fi film on a most dangerous mission that might be your last, who would you choose? And so naturally, the Robert Pattinson stands on Twitter got involved and Brie said, anyone with Robert Pattinson. So high life. But he is doing a new film with Christopher Nolan. So that may involve space or time or something. So we could have another one to add there. And obviously we had a few more reminders into Stella. So around the table quickly, which crews would you want to be joining up with?
Galaxy Quest crew. They're fun. They're fun. They're fun ones, yeah. Sigourney Weaver, Tim Allen, Alan Rickman, Monk, the guy that plays Monk.
Sam Rockwell,
yeah. Monk.
Yeah, Monk.
Monk is cool.
And Monk is in it.
Monk is in it.
Yeah, Ella?
I would join the crew on board the USS Callister in the Black Mirror episode.
Really? You want to be controlled by that guy?
Oh, but have you seen their outfits?
Oh, that's the main thing. I'll be controlled by a creepy man in
his room. As long as I look great while sweet jumpsuit. I'll fly into space, into oblivion.
Steph, now that Sam's stolen your galaxy,
I'd have to join the crew of Red Dwarf, so I think I'd have some fun times.
Yeah, and aesthetically quite similar to High Life as well, just with but less sexiness.
I don't know.
Yeah, Rimmer, he knows his stuff. I'll probably go for the USS Yorktown, which is in Star Trek Beyond, which is the amazing twisty, turny city ship that's a bit like the one at Interstellar, and it's got Michael Giacchino's best song from the soundtrack is the Yorktown track. And so I imagine if you live there, that song by Michael Giacchino definitely plays within this fictional world. So that is Amazing Grace and High Life, which is out in cinemas this week. But Sam, you are our home cinema correspondent. What is happening on demand?
Well, on demand, you've got the Claire Denis collection. So if you're going to be in a Claire Denis completist, we have quite a few other films, including Trouble Every Day, which is a delightful romp. We have 35 Shots of Rum and Beau Travail and a few others. Also out this week in cinemas and on demand, Madeline's Madeline, Josephine Decker's. Yeah, Ella's a big fan.
I love it. It's, dare I say, it's a masterpiece. Just going to drop that word and I'm going to let everyone carry on. Yeah. It's outstanding.
Yeah, and people may not know, but Steph is part of the Bechdel Test Fest and you've done some wonderful illustrated postcards for this film
postcards.
As well. So make sure you follow Steph on Twitter and check those out. And if you've got any thoughts on High Life or Amazing Grace, then let us know on Twitter. We'll put our podcast call out on there. So if you've got any thoughts on these films or for our tweet for next week, do let us know. If it's your first time listening to the show, you can subscribe. Do that on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Whilst you're there, if you could leave us a review or a comment, that would be absolutely wonderful. If you want to keep up with us, you can follow Sam on Twitter.
@SamHowlett_1.
Steph, you are at?
I am at _StephWatts.
Ella, you are?
EFE Kemp.
And I am at Jake H. Cunningham. Thank you so much for listening. Farewell.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.